Have you ever thought of what's that sweet spot where art, technology, and psychology meet? Well, today's episode is going to be all about that because today's guest is Francesco Walker. Francesco is a professor at the Leiden University, and he also studies ways in which humans interact with art and technology. So join in, strap in for an episode of Method in Madness, which will be unique in its experience and the learnings will be totally out of the world. Please help me welcome Francesco.
Method in Madness.
Welcome to Method in Madness, Francesco. How are you doing today?
Hi, Sabi. I'm absolutely great. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's really great to be here with you today.
It's my honor because one thing in Method in Madness, I try to interview people from various walks of life, artists, actors, theaters, but very rarely I have come across someone who brings two worlds together. And what I love in your profile and your work is you bring two worlds that not necessarily have a lot in common, at least from a commoner's point of view. Maybe you see things overlaps, but you bring art and technology. So firstly, how did you get that idea? And what is this idea all about? Can you tell us?
Yes, with great pleasure. And I understand completely when you say, in my view, like at first sight, it looks like these two fields do not have a lot in common, but they do. They do have a lot in common. They have in common probably a lot more than you might realize. Mm-hmm. So, in a nutshell, I study how humans interact with art and technology. And talking about the things that these two fields have in common, first of all, they can be investigated through a lot of the same methods, through a lot of the same tools. So just to give you some practical examples, I do a lot of mobile eye tracking technology research. I'm not sure how familiar you are with...
I'm not at all.
Well, eye tracking is actually a really, really cool technology.
Okay.
Because eye tracking allows us to see exactly what people are looking at. And you can imagine that this can be extremely useful both when we study, cultural environments, but also when we study technological environments. So again, practical examples, because I'm a very big fan of those. When, for example, we study visitors in museums,
yeah,
mobile eye tracking allows us to see exactly what museum visitors are looking at. And that is extremely important if we want to know, for example, if adults and children view paintings in a different way. That is actually something that a lot of our research show. But when we go to technology, I study, for example, trust in automated driving technology, trust in self-driving cars. And, then we can use mobile eye tracking technology to see, are there certain distractions in the environment that we need to take into account? In the car, what are you looking at? If you need to interact with different users, if you need to interact with pedestrians, are you looking at those pedestrians? That can all be done objectively with mobile eye tracking technology, with eye tracking technology. And this is just to give you one example. We can also use physiological measures to study emotional responses to certain stimuli. And again, we can do this when we interact with technology, we can do this when we interact with art. We can study emotional responses, we can study stress, anxiety, etc., etc., etc. And these are all, very objective measures. And I'm a very, very big fan of those measures because they allow us, questionnaires, extremely useful tool, but it's really, I think, through physiology and eye tracking that we can really see, for me, we can really study what these people are doing. Taking out some of the biases that, of course, kick in when we're using questionnaires. But that is, so okay, methods, of course, element in common, but maybe the most important thing that for me art and technology have in common is maybe my passion towards these topics.
Okay.
As well, I'm a researcher, I'm an academic, and I always feel that in academia we need to be driven by passion. I come from Italy, I come from Rome, I come from one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
Absolutely.
And art is everywhere in Rome. So I grew up with a passion for art.
Yeah.
I want to say that Rome has two things. It has art, but also has a lot of traffic. So art, traffic, two things that if you visit Rome, and probably I can imagine that a lot of the people listening to this podcast will have visited Rome in the past.
Yeah, of course.
You do see these two things, right? So, I was like, okay, I'm passionate towards art, but I also see all these issues that we have with transportation in my home country. And these two elements did drive my research. I started studying art perception, but at the same time, pretty much at the same time, through my PhD, I started investigating how humans interact with self-driving cars, because I always thought, self-driving cars can be a way to solve some of these transportation issues. So art perception, but also trust in technology, have been two common themes of my work. And finally, I wanted to mention that again, both art and technology, they address crucial societal needs. Crucial societal needs. We need art, we really do. I think that especially in the time right now, we tend to think that art becomes less and less important, but we know that teaching about art really helps people. It's important for our own personal development, for our own education. So studying this can be crucial from an educational point of view, from a societal point of view. And of course, when we talk about technology and the societal relevance about it, right now with the verge of AI, artificial intelligence, large language models, as well as self-driving mobility. I mean, we need to understand how people interact with these different elements, and both, I believe, link very, very nicely to society.
That's really brilliantly said. And I have so many thoughts running in my head. Like, I love art. I wish I could draw, but I don't can't draw that well. But I love looking at painting because it's so sometimes abstract, sometimes thoughtful, and it triggers and tickles emotions based on the day, mood, like how am I feeling, how am I feeling. And it's one of those, like, yeah, it has this effect that very few things have. And the other thing you said about questionnaire, I'm personally not a big fan of questionnaires because I think it leads to a lot of biased results. There is always a lot of I've had instances where organizations have done questionnaires and they've implemented things based on the questionnaire answers, and the outcome has been so different. Like, people have actually been upset and everything, but the questionnaire clearly asks for this. And I really don't think it gives you a gospel truth. It can give you a feeling, but I think this mobile eye technology that you're talking about, I think I from what I hear from you, is way more insightful because the chances of pretentiousness is much less, right? Because your raw emotions are captured. If I
I think that's very well said. In a way, I think that we can say our eyes do not really lie. You look at something and we can see exactly what you look at. And okay, it is true, as you mentioned, questionnaires come with an entire set of issues. Then again, we can try to contrast some of those issues by using standardized questionnaires, by developing properly. Sometimes it's also good, we can also check if the results collected through the eye tracking data, if the eye tracking data actually correlates with some of the questionnaire's results. That can be, in my opinion, is a very nice way to move forward. I do not want to bring across the message, but we just need to completely remove questionnaires out of the picture. But I think that more objective measures can definitely be a good addition to both.
I think I love the world of change and also behavior change. And one of the bottleneck that I often face when I'm having discussion is how do you measure that the behavior change has been successful or the change has been successful? Now it's not a sales number that can be easily quantified and measured. And when it comes to these kind of behavioral change, it's very hard to measure it because, especially in questionnaire forms, because like for a month or so, you might feel nothing has changed, but the catch up is a bit later. And what is the right time? And it really varies from person to person.
Definitely, definitely.
And a lot needs to be felt. And a lot of when you have to measure things based on feelings, I think. Especially corporates that have now mastered the art of being very blue and really lack that measurement tools but I think we can talk about this a lot, and I will come to you in person with this mobile eye technology. I have another question. You because you said there's a lot in common when it comes to technology and art. So when you measure people's mobile through the mobile eye technology, what similarities do you find in people's reaction and when they look at a beautiful painting versus they look at a cutting edge technology? What are the similarities and maybe what are the dissimilarities, if
Yeah,
any?
that's a very good question, Sabian. Actually, it's a question. It's very hard to answer this question because, well, one element that I always like to point out when we are running eye tracking research is that you can really get buried in data. Okay, I mean, just imagine every eye movement that you're making is a data point. Okay,
Yes.
so if we want to see what are the similarities and what are the differences, what's really crucial is what is the research question that we're trying to answer.
Sure.
So these similarities and differences, of course, always link to what we are looking for. If we approach eye tracking research in a more exploratory way, then it's very, very easy to just get lost in this vast, vast, vast amount of data. So when we're talking about, for example, a lot of my work with museums investigates how people view art. Okay, so do children and do adults view art differently? And in this case, we see very, very strong differences between these two groups. So we see that children are more bottom-up driven. That bottom-up is a cognitive psychology term that indicates that children are more attracted to elements of a painting that tend to stand out due to form and color. This is what kids do. But adults are more top-down driven, meaning that they're driven more by and automatically, that they're driven more by their knowledge and expectations about the artist and about what they're expecting to look at. So these are very strong differences between children and adults. But when we move to technology, although we are using we're doing again a lot of eye tracking research, we are interested in different questions. So for example, we might be interested in how people interact with the HMI, with the human machine interface. So, with all the commands, with all the alerts that they get in certain instances, and we can check if these are distracting, if these are placed in good locations. So the technology is the same, but the research questions that we investigate in the two fields are actually very, very, very different.
Okay. Wow. I'm both. I'm sometimes getting lost in thoughts because it's so intriguing and new for me. I'm like, Wow, I didn't think this is what happens, but let me collect my thoughts. It's a whole new world and it's fascinating. You love art. You said your connection to Rome, Italy, and love for art, and how art and messages and stories through art needs to be preserved for generations, and it should not be less relevant in today's time. Can we use art and maybe mobile eye technology to facilitate change? Is there any change mantra or any seeds of that can help people change behavior change that can be done through any art form that can trigger or give that little spark?
Well, that's such an interesting question. And I mean, art is change, right? I mean, when we talk about art, in
Yes.
my opinion, we are already talking about change. All art movements, or not all, but most art movements are driven by change. So, and you see this with museums as well. The way in which we present artworks today is not the same way in which we presented it. 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago, it changes. But the way in which we present it also needs to adapt to the visitor. And this is something that definitely we can investigate with mobile eye tracking technology. So again, to give you a practical example, because my work is very applied, so I like to stick to applied examples.
Absolutely.
So, today we know that children and adults view art in a different way. And this also means that we can't present art in the same way to both kind of visitors. So actually, very recently, we did some work with the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. That's the National Museum of the Netherlands. And what we did was actually quite straightforward. We asked them to view three different paintings. We asked children to view three different paintings. And we gave them the painting descriptions that are currently on display at the museum. So if you go to the museum right now, you will see these painting descriptions. But then we also gave them painting descriptions that were specifically tailored to their age group. And these were descriptions with a more, storytelling kind of format. And they were really written by the educational staff of the museum for this specific age group. And we're talking about children that are between 10 and 12 years old. And then we had a control group. And, in research and science, you always want a control group. And our control group received no description at all. So these were kids. We just placed them in front of the paintings and we were like, just view the painting for 30 seconds. And I think that what we found was really striking because we saw, so the kids, the children that received the adult description seemed quite lost looking at this painting, okay? They were a little bit all over the place. But when we gave them the child description, so the specific description tailored to their group, they really focused on those elements of the description. So, this really showed us that these descriptions led to more engagement with these specific artworks. But what I thought was really the striking finding of this entire work was that the control group, so when we gave them no description at all, these guys showed exactly the same patterns that the ones that received the adult descriptions. So, what does this mean? Like, summarizing this thing, adult description or no description makes no difference. Like, it was exactly the same. So, this really shows that we need to start, if we're interested in children visiting museums, and I want to say we definitely are, we need to start also tailoring these experiences a little bit more to them. Giving them adult descriptions or adult experiences does not automatically lead to a good museum experience for them.
Wow, that's really insightful. I'm thinking I'm not questioning when I visit museum how I respond to art. I'm thinking in that sense, but I have two more questions for you. One is of course related to change because I love change, and Imagine you get hired as the vice president of change in a large corporate where there has been bureaucracy for many, many years. People are resistant to change, resistant to change. They view every new thing as danger or just, pushback. You get hired to be the change manager and bring change, whether it's behavior change, it's process change, all of that. Based on your experience, based on your research, based on your insight that you've gathered in your work so far, what's the first change that you will bring in that organization?
Oh, difficult question. Probably one of the first changes I would apply, I would push more interdisciplinary collaboration. I think that's very important. It's very important in research. It's very important in the academic world, but I believe it can be important in more company environments as well. In my line of work, I collaborate with museums, I collaborate with automotive companies. If I just do my work, but I don't listen to the needs of the partners that are supposed to apply my work, that doesn't work. It doesn't work. Can do it, I can do it, I can publish it, but at the end, my work, my results will not be applied. So for me, it is always extremely crucial. For example, with museums, I do not want to borrow the museum for my work. I want to collaborate. I want to make sure that we discuss and that we make sure that what I'm doing is actually useful for you. And I find this incredibly important, but also extremely challenging. If you get minds from very different environments, it's people from different worlds. We think differently. We are used to different standards. We are used to different kind of colleagues. But for me, the challenge is also part of the fun. It's also, understanding how these worlds work. That's at the end how you connect them, in my opinion. And
Absolutely.
you're talking about change. If I would be the vice president of change, I would try to push a little bit more collaboration between different parties.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you will be surprised how many teams struggle with it. Like when I get reached out for any workshop, it can be about change or in lack of innovation, ideation. And as we break it down, the real struggle is co in collaboration. I mean, I think everybody's perfectly capable of doing their job creatively, effectively, but it's just that they work in silos. They don't talk. They don't, there's like too much. They work as islands, and therefore the collaboration struggles, and that often is not seen as a essential problem, and but it is an essential problem. So I think you just hit the nail on the head with that. One last question. Since the podcast is called Method in Madness, I like to ask everybody, what has been that moment of madness in your life or career? Something that you've done today, when you look back at it, you think, oh my God, what was I thinking? But thank God I did it, but I'm not sure I'm going to do it again. What's the moment of madness for you? The mild said you
That's
have
quite
quite a
easy.
few.
No. That's I Sabia, I understand your question completely, and I want to say that's quite easy for me to answer. But probably for me, my moment of madness was to decide to keep going for both fields, to keep investigating technology, but at the same time doing art, fueled by passion. My moment of madness was I wanna do what I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about these topics. I will keep doing both. And it's strange in an academic world, trying to go in two different directions. Of course, I have some elements in common, but of course they are different directions. I think that many people would consider it mad. And I can tell you, I'm loving every second of it, and I will never go back.
I love that answer. The reason the podcast is called Method in Madness is because friends of mine call me Method in Madness because I have those stroke of madnesses where you have You sometimes I don't even have the idea. I have a conviction of an idea and just went ahead with it. And sometimes best ideas, best work, best impact in the world are created with conviction, passion, and madness. And so I'm really happy to see someone who is a living example of it and is proving to everybody that what a person can do and achieve when there is madness and then there is method. So thank you for that answer.
No, my absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining Method in Madness. It was really an insightful and eye-opening chat. Like I said, you come from a world that is so fascinating. At the same time, I often didn't know much about it, but now that I hear from you, I can hear for hours. It's really fascinating to hear it. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Oh, my absolute pleasure, Sabi, and thank you for inviting me to the podcast. It was absolutely great to share with you and with your listeners some of the work we do.
Thank you so much. And that was yet another episode of Method in Madness. Like I promise every time, in a few weeks I will be back with yet another episode, way more madness and lots of inspiration. Till then, stay mad, because there is no magic without a little bit of madness.